This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
As we extend into screen life, we build a digital body. Records of where we visited, shopped, blogged, or tweeted are fed into algorithms determining what we see, not just advertising, but content. Information and disinformation flow together. Who does that leave on the ground, in the chair, the physical foot of the instrument? What is this techno-hybrid being you have become? A French intellectual, little known in English, is our witness.
Crashes, derailments, explosions, destruction, pollution, the greenhouse effect, acid rain, Minamata, Chernobyl, Seveso, etc. In those days of deterrence, we eventually got used, after a fashion, to our new nightmares and, thanks, among other things, to live TV, the long death throes of the planet assume the familiar guise of one series of scoops among others. Thus, having reached a high degree of soft stupor, we simply contented ourselves with ticking off the events, with enumerating the unfortunate victims of our scientific reverses, our technical and industrial mistakes.
When Paul Virilio passed away in Paris 2018, he drew widespread tributes for his books like The Information Bomb, The Administration of Fear, and University of Disaster. In this program, we examine Virilio in the very circumstances of breakdown he predicted. Can he help? David Levi Strauss writes, "I think theorists should be ranked according to their prescience, and Virilio is near the top in this Vatic order. He predicted the Gulf War, 9/11, the big data surveillance state, and the coming big accident. When everything is finally connected, then everything can finally fail." In the same tribute to Virilio, published in the Brooklyn Rail, Naif Yeya adds this update for our times, peppered with phrases from Virilio himself. Among many phenomena Virilio anticipated was the grotesque state of politics in the Trump era. Referring to the triumph of Silvio Berlusconi, he wrote in Ground Zero, 2002, "Italy has just toppled over into a two-party system of the third kind, in which the alternative is no longer between classic left and right, but between politics and the media." He warned us that telereality was invading the seats of public places, telecracy over representative democracy's man, the triumph of audience ratings over universal suffrage. Paul Virilio was born in Paris in 1932, but he grew up in Brittany on the Northwest. In June 1940, Paul Virilio, the 9-year-old boy, was living in his then home city of Nantes on the Loire River in northwest of France. After a quick aerial bombing, German troops surprised everyone with a lightning-fast occupation of the town. Suddenly, they were just there. That was a formative experience for young Virilio, to which he returned in many of his books. In 1940, the expectation by everybody in French society was this war would be like the last. World War I was a plodding affair, advancing trench by trench. Besides, France had constructed the impregnable Maginot Line along the border with Germany. The speed of the German conquest of North France changed the conception of war and of time itself. Robert Hassan wrote about the acceleration of everything in his 2009 book, Empires of Speed, Time and the Acceleration of Politics and Society. Hassan writes,
"The present empire of speed, based upon computer-driven acceleration, is one where there is no one in control, because politics can no longer synchronize, keep up, with the pace of change that has become an end in itself."
Now that is pure Virilio, really. When the complex systems speed up, there is more than just an increased production over time. There are cascading impacts that create different realities and different demands on the minds required to comprehend that change. All through Virilio's work, we find this fascination and horror with speed, with acceleration. Virilio claims we need a science to investigate speed itself, which he calls dromology. He assigns speed itself a kind of territory, the dromosphere. All this becomes clearer as we talk soon with our guest John David Ebert. And like all of Virilio's writings, we cross these boundaries in understanding several times before we really see and understand them. Patience is required and rewarded.
Radio EcoShock.
There is very little online about the work of Paul Virilio in English, but you can find a two-part introduction and assessment on YouTube from John David Ebert. Ebert is a cultural critic, intellectual, and author of 25 books. He investigates difficult minds, and he takes us along for the ride. From Arizona, John David Ebert, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, I'm currently in Santa Fe now, Santa Fe, New Mexico, but thank you.
All right. Well, what attracted you to this French philosopher?
Well, Paul Virilio, I was researching for my 2010 book, Dead Celebrities, Living Icons, and I had not bothered reading French postmodern philosophy up to that point. So I decided to read Jean Baudrillard because I knew a little bit about his philosophy of the simulacrum, and I knew he would have interesting things to say about avatars and so forth, and he did. But as I was reading through him, I noticed his references to this other individual, Paul Virilio, and I looked him up, did a Google on him, and I saw that he was famous for his ideas about technology. And at the time, I was very much interested in reading anyone and everyone who had theories about technology. And so I started picking up Virilio's books and reading Baudrillard and then Virilio back and forth until I was completely addicted to both of them, especially Virilio. And so that's when he entered into my life at that point.
So what the heck does Virilio mean by the term the dromosphere?
The dromosphere is his central idea, and it comes from the Greek word dromos, meaning speed. And so he has this idea of that as our civilization has progressed, especially since the 19th century, things have gotten faster and faster and faster. There are two revolutions, he says, that went through the 19th century. One is the transport revolution, where we moved from horses to trains, and then eventually to automobiles, and then in the 20th century, of course, with rockets and airplanes. So the physical form of the human body has been accelerated through space faster and faster. And he also has this idea that as we move faster, the phenomenology of our perception changes. Like if we get into a car and we drive fast, the windshield becomes almost this kind of screen that distorts our perception of the landscape around us. Lateral vision disappears. We scan the windshield for any kind of collisions or whatsoever. And the whole phenomenology of what we see isn't really out there. It's in here. And so in a certain sense, the driver becomes a kind of artist with the passenger as a kind of spectator. But also the other thing, and this is more important than the phenomenology of speed, is that as we speed up, the danger of accidents actually increases. And so he has this idea that with each technological invention of motion through the dromosphere, it brings into being a new kind of accident. The invention of the first boats brought the shipwreck into being right along with it. And as in the myth of Daedalus and Icarus, the Greek smith who invents wings and basically the first airplane to fly, but his son Icarus falls and crashes. And so the Greeks are already sensitive to the idea that when you invent a new technology like flying, you're also inventing the plane crash. You invent trains and you invent the train crash. And now he says we're on a threshold of acceleration to the point where the media are now accelerating and have laid the foundations. Globalization and the global, what he calls the vision machine, which is all the electromagnetic apparatus, have now laid the foundations for the first global accident. And I think that more or less there he predicted the COVID pandemic.
So what is it about Virilio's global instant that causes yesterday's story and then really almost all previous history to disappear for a lot of people? When I talk with people on the street or even online, it seems like they haven't built up anything from the history that humanity got until, you know, maybe 2001.
Yes, and that's because of the other revolution, not the transport revolution, which accelerates history, but the acceleration of the virtual with the information revolution that went along right beside it, first with the telegraph, then with the telephone, and then radio, and then eventually computers, and now the internet. There has been an acceleration such that it has created what he calls the aesthetics of disappearance, the first instance of which is if you're sitting in a movie theater, you have what's called persistence of vision, at least in the celluloid days, where each frame is constantly evanescing and vanishing, but you have persistence of vision so you can assemble a coherent image out of it without seeing the frames in between. But then as the information technologies, what he calls the information bomb, have exploded on us, we get this constant aesthetics of evanescence in which the present becomes the only thing that's real, and the delayed mental space of history disappears, the space in which an event happens, then there's sufficient time for us to reflect on it and then write books about it, articles, magazines. That's the old Gutenbergian world of the delayed mental space. Now we don't have that delay because everything is instantaneous. Every event that happens, happens simultaneously all over the planet. And so we wind up with this aesthetics of disappearance in which we have an acceleration of the virtual and we're stuck with it. And so history vanishes and all we get now are no longer historical actualities, but simply random scattered events like 911, say, or just pick your event. And they're disconnected and fragmented because our minds are wed to the present moment because of these technologies.
That's brilliant. I really get that, especially when we see how the news moves from one strange accident or shooting or somebody runs down others in a parade. That becomes the focus for half an hour. And then it disappears, and then we get a new accident. And Virilio essentially said that now what we have, this civilization, is an accident.
Yeah, the whole thing is an accident. That's right. That's a good way of putting it. Yeah, and none of those stories are connected at all. They're just random. They seem to be like Charlottesburg happens, and then it's in the news for 48 hours, and then suddenly it never happens. No one ever refers to it.
Not long after you posted your two-part YouTube video on Virilio, you published the book Age of Catastrophe, Disaster and Humanity in Modern Times. What in Virilio's work reveals a coming age of catastrophe?
That book was inspired by my interaction with Paul Virilio, especially his fascination with accidents. And he was founding what he called an accidentology. So the logos or the study of accidents, which was totally new to me. I'd never encountered it anywhere ever before. And I thought it was fascinating to study accidents almost as works of art. Or he wanted at one point to found a museum of the accident in Paris. I don't think it ever did happen. So I took this idea and I ran with it and I started thinking, well, maybe there's a lot more in these accidents than people think. For example, Virilio would talk about these events and he would make references, oblique references to the Titanic, let's say, or the Hindenburg, or the space shuttles. But he would never go into detail on them. And so I decided to write a book where each chapter would be devoted to a different accident, starting with the Titanic and the Hindenburg. And the book is divided into three epochs then. Paleomodernity, which is essentially goes all the way down to World War II, then neomodernity, which moves from World War II basically down to the year 2000, when I see accidents becoming so large that they are planetary in their scale. And so when we start with that first epoch with the Titanic and the Hindenburg, we have these very symmetrical accidents that have a cause and effect that's easy to identify, and they don't ramify across space and time. They're contained. Certain specific things have happened with the Titanic, so now we need to make the telegraph 24 hours, for instance. We need to have enough lifeboats for everyone. So, and then we're done with it, and we move on. A certain number of people die, and that's it. But in the second epoch, and the book only has two accidents from paleomodernity, in the second epoch, though, we move into an age, such as with Bhopal, the accident that was a gas leak in India in the 80s, a poison gas called 7 that leaked, a giant cloud, killed a lot of people and harmed a lot of others, and also Chernobyl and Fukushima. Accidents like this are no longer containable in one place and one time, and they keep ramifying their effects even across generations. I mean, there are unborn children in Ukraine who were close enough to Chernobyl that they will bear birth defects on for generations. So the effects of these accidents in the middle epoch here get larger and larger, but not quite yet planetary. And then we move into the age of catastrophe proper right around the year 2000, where we start getting planetary scale disasters like these giant tsunamis in 2004 and the one in 2003, I believe it was, that brought YouTube into being so people could upload their videos of it. So YouTube was actually born out of a catastrophe, note that. And those giant tsunamis, the Japan one that caused the Fukushima disaster, huge tsunamis, and now ultimately the one that we're facing is the big one, which is the collision of industrial civilization with the biosphere, which is global warming. And global warming is now planetary in scale. It's a planetary accident that is the result of Western civilization's technologies crashing into the biosphere, just like the Titanic crashing into a 10,000-year-old piece of Greenland ice. And so now the ice is melting as the result of all of this CO2 that we've been outgassing for well over a century now. The parts per million are up around 412. I just looked today, 412. When I wrote the book 10 years ago, it was at 395. So the CO2 levels are going up astronomically fast, and there's a direct correlation between those levels and global average mean temperature, which has risen by 1.2 degrees over the past century, and also sea levels have risen by a foot. So this is what we're looking at here, and that's what that book is about.
Yes, we're living those catastrophes here in British Columbia, where I am. We had the superheat dome that killed over 600 people, which was a total shock here in Canada. And then we had these atmospheric rivers that closed off all the highways to Vancouver, one of the biggest cities of Canada, with landslides. The whole earth was destabilized. So it seems like catastrophe is now just a way of life.
It is for us, yes, and almost to the point now where because of man-made technologies interacting with the planet, with the ecology, all the ecological systems, you almost can't even say anymore that there is any such a thing as a natural disaster. They're all man-made now because there's a direct correlation between the rising of the sea levels and the heating of the seas to produce larger and larger hurricanes. They're getting larger and larger and more severe. And we're also getting hotter and hotter years. Every year seems to be hotter than the one before it. I think the two hottest years on record now are 2020 and 2016. And the seven hottest years on record have all now transpired over the past decade. Basically, it's getting hotter and hotter, with more and more CO2 and more floods. We've had a lot of floods. I guess you guys had a lot of floods recently, didn't you, in Vancouver?
So as I read Virilio's books, he seems to be in mourning. He mourns quietly the disbelief in his Catholic faith. But the real thing that's bothering him, it seems to me, is that we don't even have an agreement on what is real. People have alternative facts, so they say, and there seems to be more people believing information coming online rather than what their own senses or their own mind might tell them. What do you think?
Well, yes, I mean, that's part of the information bomb, what Virilio calls the information bomb with the acceleration of virtual reality through the internet. It also has the effect of deworlding people. And this is what I call hypermodernity, which is the same thing, the information version of the age of catastrophe, which began in 1995 when the internet was turned over to the public and made part of the public sector. And ever since then, we've seen all of physical reality pretty much disintegrate. Our shopping malls are now ghost relics on the landscape. Everything went in through Amazon and purchasing things online. And so it created this kind of suction effect where the entire world interior of capitalism was sucked into the internet. All our devices and gadgets, cameras, phones, have been sucked into the internet now. And so digital technology comes in to displace electronic technology, which was bequeathed to us by Stanford during World War II, which was analog. And so all the analog technology is gone. Our movies now are strictly, they're no longer celluloid. They no longer have a physical substrate to them, anchoring the images in something real. That's gone. The images are entirely digital. They're artificial. And as we know, and as I've learned, I had a data crash earlier this year where I lost lots of files on my hard drive. These technologies are unstable. They don't last. They are evanescent, just like Virilio said, and they completely destabilize our sense of what we think is real. And so people get the avatar, my Facebook avatar, let's say, my YouTube avatar, these become deworlded entities. That is to say, they're removed from the locality of place, time, and circumstance, and they're put inside the internet at the speed of light. And so right now, as we talk through this conversation, we are talking at the speed of light because our data, our voices are translating energy into electronic or digital impulses. So we're moving at the speed of light right now, and that's basically what has happened to the world. And as Einstein pointed out, when things move at light speed, certain phenomena happen, such as the fact that time slows down and stops. That's essentially Virilio's point about history collapsing into the present moment. Mass becomes infinite, And no object, of course, can go the speed of light other than light particles themselves, photons, because they don't have mass. But things become compressed and flattened at the speed of light, including our sense of subjectivities as a human subject. That's flattening out, too. So this technology, as it accelerates thoughts and ideas and images to the speed of light, is extraordinarily unstable, flat, and really figure without ground. There are no world horizons that anchor this material to something real and concrete. I no longer, for instance, read physical books much anymore. I read almost everything online now, reluctantly so, but that's just the way the culture has gone. And so I sort of miss my contact with the smell of the printed page and being able to write on the pages as I read. That's been derealized by this information bomb.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is culture critic and author John David Ebert. We are trying to understand the continuing crisis, and we're looking at the work of French philosopher Paul Virilio. We know that information companies build profiles about each of us, and they tailor not just advertising, but a lot more. For example, algorithms on Facebook and YouTube are geared to stoke fear or anger. Virilio saw this coming, didn't he?
Yes, in one of his last books, The Administration of Fear, which is the book that I talk about on YouTube, he talked about the administration of fear being a byproduct of this acceleration, of this information bomb. We're constantly in a state of panic. When something happens, it happens now to us all, and so there's this global pressure on us to synchronize our emotional responses to disasters such as 9-1-1, such as COVID. These are now synchronized at a global level, and so especially with COVID, we're all made to feel fearful by Dr. Fauci, by the World Health Organization, whoever's in control, the NIH. We're made to feel fear through the synchronization of all of our emotions via the simultaneity and instantaneity of the Internet. And so it does. It creates this environment of fear and anxiety. And we're also always being sort of sadistically having pressure put on us to catch up to the latest technological invention, to update our Facebook page, to get on to the latest site, to make sure we have the latest phone, without our compliance at all. No one ever checks. This is never put up for a referendum or a vote. It just happens. So there is no political economy, as Virilio says, to keep up with this pace of change. We're just expected to adapt or die or drop out.
Should we consider Paul Virilio as an update on Marshall McLuhan, the Canadian, from the printed word to computer screens? Is there some of that?
Yes, very much so. Virilio is the study of technology. Technology is itself a form of media. And so media studies comprises all technological extensions. And McLuhan had this idea that all of our technologies are extensions of the physical body. For example, clothing is an extension of the skin. The wheel is an extension of the foot. The computer is an extension of the central nervous system, and so on. And so he founded media studies in the 1950s, along with Harold Innes at the University of Toronto, and became famous in the 60s. He was on every talk show in existence in the 60s, talking about media. And then sort of Virilio has, of course, read him and studied him, as has Baudrillard, and inherited that tradition and transformed it into French postmodern philosophical theory, a philosophical thought, thinking about technology. And so he comes right out of that same tradition with a recognition of these two different streams, the transport revolution and the information revolution. So he very much is the sequel, the update to McLuhan. I found him to be just as brilliant as McLuhan. McLuhan is my favorite thinker of all time as far as media studies goes. I think he's the best.
And you wrote books and YouTube videos on other difficult French philosophers. Does Virilio fit in with groundbreakers like Michel Foucault or Gilles Deleuze or Félix Guattari?
Yes and no. He is part of that whole, let's say, thought ecumene or thought ecology. So he belongs in there. He knew those guys. He's from the same world, but he always felt like an outsider because first he started as an artist and he thought he was going to be an artist. And so his interests were in architecture and art, not in philosophy. So he was different in that sense. And he's also different in the sense that he's the only one, as far as I know, out of that group who is not a Marxist, but a Christian, which gives him a very different view, a different slant. And his primary competitor, I think, was Baudrillard. I think the two were sort of in competition with each other, and they are the most like each other out of that group that includes Foucault and Deleuze and Guattari and Lacan and all of those guys. So Yes and no. He's definitely part of that world.
What is it about French thought that really didn't penetrate very deeply in North America or other parts of the world? It seems to be almost ghettoed into French language only. Do you think that it translates well, or what is why don't we know more about Paul Virilio?
Well, he's obscure in a certain sense because he's so difficult to read and is so erudite. Same problem with Baudrillard as well, and also Deleuze and Guattari, especially with their masterpiece, A Thousand Plateaus, which I think is the best book written by any of those guys. It's an absolute masterpiece, and it's extraordinarily difficult to read. Which is one of the reasons why I devoted YouTube videos to trying to popularize these ideas. But on the other hand, they have penetrated into the world of American academia through, in the 1980s, Derrida especially penetrated with deconstruction into the world of the universities and began the process of deconstruction that has led us to, I think, the deplorable situation that America is in right now with the woke left hijacking everything, canceling everything, and spreading this deconstructive nihilism that started in American universities in the 80s, and now, it's being taught to our children in grade schools. It's absolutely ridiculous. Their minds are not ready. They're not adapted for this. They're not ready for that kind of thinking. So it has had a huge effect. Derrida and Foucault especially, who both have this similar attitude of nihilism and the getting rid of historical meta-narratives. It's Foucault who announces in the introduction to the Archaeology of Knowledge that we don't need to bother anymore with macro-historical narratives. We're just going to study micro-narratives, small-scale narratives that are European-only. Because if we talk about, let's say, Indian history or Chinese history, then that's a form of intellectual colonialism, which it absolutely is not. It's a form of narrow-minded thinking. And so I was slow to warm to the French, and now I've had my flirtation and fascination with French philosophy. And I don't really, I recognize its greatness, but I think it's a very small greatness when compared to, say, media studies, American media studies, which I think is much more insightful, or, and beyond that, to German, of course, great German philosophical idealist thinking that starts with Immanuel Kant and goes all the way down through to Heidegger and Peter Sloterdijk, who is a contemporary German thinker. I much prefer German thinking. I think it's much more profound and satisfying, and it's not deconstructive. It's not about getting rid of everything. The French started that with the French Revolution. Let's get rid of everything. Let's get rid of the calendar and put in a metric system. Let's get rid of all historical references to gods and biblical myths and so forth. It's just ludicrous. So there's a great line, a very solid line that extends from the French Revolution down to Foucault and Derrida, and the very sad thing that is happening now with the effects of that nihilism on American socioculture.
Well, what about you? I mean, we are in a difficult time. Do you find yourself in pessimism because of that?
Well, yes and no. I'm kind of an optimistic pessimist, I suppose you would say. I recognize that historical processes are necessary, and sometimes difficult processes, as in the living of your daily life, are necessary to go through to get to another point, to learn something so that you can get to another point. That's one of the reasons why terrible things happen to us. We're here to learn. So, yes and no. I mean, it's pessimistic in the sense that the culture is disintegrating. I think Oswald Spengler nailed that when he wrote The Decline of the West in 1918, and he predicted that it would be downhill for the West from that point, which it absolutely has been. But that doesn't mean it can't be great spiritual experiences that can happen or transformations in human consciousness that are undergoing right now, metamorphosis even as we speak, and we don't even know it because we're not aware of these processes. They're mostly unconscious and subliminal and macro-historical. And it was McLuhan who said that, the fish can't see the water that it's swimming in. It's only when you come out of that water that you can look back, oh, there's the water, now here's the air. Let's analyze the water. And so we're swimming in the waters of a very difficult time for this planet. And the course is just to grab onto something strong, i.e. spiritual. For me, I'm very spiritually grounded, and I think spirituality is the most important thing about being human, and it is the thing that will weather any storm, no matter what.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is culture critic and author John David Ebert. We are trying to understand the continuing crisis, and we're looking at the work of French philosopher Paul Virilio. Everything seems destabilized and fuzzy like a dangerous mystery. I used to think, well, I sort of understand global affairs, but now there are so many twists and changes coming that, as you say, we can't see the water that we're in.
The changes are accelerating just faster and faster, just like Virilio said that they would.
What other tools do you recommend to people who are shocked or puzzled or seriously worried about these times?
Well, to read good books, that is to say good books that where you know the author has some sort of spiritual grounding in something. And it doesn't have to be New Age spirituality. It can be Christian spirituality, as is the case with Virilio, or with Marshall McLuhan, who was a Catholic. They were very grounded men, individuals, or an individual like Joseph Campbell with his study of all the world religions and mythologies. It needs to be something that has a spiritual foundation to it, like Rudolf Steiner, the great German mystic who founded the Waldorf schools and Anthroposophy and so forth. Those are the things that I would recommend grounding oneself in, because when you have a very strongly built-up spiritual immune system, then you can get through anything. Because the culture as a whole is not grounded. It's an atheist, materialistic society. Still, primarily to this point, that will change and is changing. I'm not, formally religious, but I am spiritual. I believe in things like reincarnation and karma. And if you believe in such things, then you begin to realize, oh, what I do, how I treat this person will have consequences at some point down the road. It's important to have that.
So as we wrap up on Paul Virilio, are there, say, two books that you would recommend people finding and reading if they want to understand what it is he has to say for us?
Yes, I would recommend The Administration of Fear and The University of Disaster, which are two of his latest books, but they're two of his best, and they're short. Short is a virtue when it comes to books these days. People don't have the attention span to read them.
And John David Ebert, how do people find you and find your work?
I have a YouTube channel. Just type in the three names there, John David Ebert, and same thing on Amazon. I have I think about 30 books total by now. I've lost count on Amazon. So that's where all the books are, and all the videos are on YouTube.
You just heard from cultural critic, editor, and author John David Ebert. Find links to follow up in my show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith. We begin our journey with Virilio's powerful book, The Information Bomb. These are my notes, but they're peppered with direct quotes from the book. The Information Bomb was originally published in French in Paris in 1998. The English language translation by Chris Turner was published in 2000 by Verso Books. It has since turned up as a free .pdf on a couple of internet sites, or you can buy the book from Amazon. First, Virilio extends to all science and scientists responsibility for the creation of extinction levels of knowledge. What extinction level of knowledge is he talking about? To name just a few, physics and the atomic bomb, genetics and genetic weapons, microbiology and germ weapons, chemical weapons, cyber weapons within cyberspace and directed outside into real-world targets. With his bitter childhood war experience behind him, Virilio suggests our society ventures into death science, allegedly in the name of patriotism and survival of our side. This drove science to become something else, an immoral sort of other. He says there is no longer any really innocent science. Then Virilio says that time has not collapsed, as Francis Fukuyama claimed in his book The End of History. It is space, at least here on Earth, geography that has collapsed. However, in later works, Virilio seems to change his mind, finding in cyber reality time too has collapsed into a single rolling instant that erases its own past. In his later book, The University of Disaster, Virilio gives the example of the stock market and interlocked financial bonds. Even a couple of decades ago, traders could watch waves of activity, perhaps starting in the Japanese or Singapore stock market. Then it would rise in Europe and finally New York. Now all that is hyperconnected, watched over 24 hours a day by computer algorithms. It is a single global entity. In the 1980s, automated nuclear firing programs called the Doomsday Machine could trigger a massive exchange of nuclear missiles by computer. Because human response might miss the event or be too slow to respond, especially where permissions from sleeping presidents are required, the hyper stock or financial market is in the same state. We live in the Cold War with the threat of annihilation by atomic weapons. But this time, Virilio says in The Information Bomb, the war is hot but unseen. It is a war breaking down the enemy while damaging the genetics of reproduction. It is a slower, unseen war on the mind, body, and soul. The weapons are programmed information aimed at programmable people. Virilio writes of metageography, where the continents have lost their geographical foundations and been supplanted by the telecontinents of a global communication system. It has become quasi-instantaneous. Perhaps you have seen graphic maps of the major hubs and swirling connections of information wrapping around the globe. That is the new metageography, where we spend more and more time, where we travel anywhere instantly, bouncing quick messages to a stranger in New Zealand or Newfoundland. Virilio sees a virtual reality that monopolizes the greater part of the economic activity of the nations and, conversely, destroys cultures, which are precisely situation in the space of the physics of the globe. The culture of a Kenyan village becomes displaced by images from the global media space. Virilio saw the end of geography beginning in the 1990s, and it ends in the information bomb. In another accident after his death, Virilio's vision of migration to cyberspace has sped up during the COVID-19 pandemic. Office, school, and social life goes virtual. It does not matter whether an employee is in London or Tokyo, or where the college student is relative to the professor. The web designer in Mumbai and the banker in Lithuania, what does it matter? We gravitate towards cyber living for entertainment, our work, and our schools, all of which become obsolete in the explosive space of the instant. The information bomb has gone off, and the new plugged individual has body ties in the fragments of what used to be a locality. As Virilio put it,
after the first bomb, the atomic bomb, which was capable of using the energy of radioactivity to smash matter, the specter of a second bomb is looming at the end of this millennium. This is the information bomb, capable of using the interactivity of information to wreck the peace between nations. On the internet, there is a permanent temptation to engage in terrorism, as it is easy to inflict damage with impunity, declared a one-time hacker, who is now a company director. There is no longer, strictly speaking, either right or left, and that, since the fall of the Berlin Wall, these things literally no longer have any meaning. All that remains is the great audiovisual dilemma, the conflict between the soft, the word, and the hard, the image.
That reading from Virilio, courtesy of Brent Ragsdale, co-host of Eco Radio KKFI Kansas City. You may need to listen to this radio program twice. Get the Radio EchoShock podcast on iTunes, or just play it from our website at ecoshock.org. Look for Virilio, Inhabiting Disaster, posted December 15, 2021.
We get from Virilio this example of a surreal global entity becoming dominant over the local, the places where humans formerly identified themselves. Earlier in his 1978 work, Popular Defense and Ecological Struggles, Virilio returned to his dread of militarism. Quote, we must, therefore, get it out of our heads that the military rushes to the aid of civilians, sets up emergency medical units and encampments for disaster victims, runs airlifts and clearing operations on the site of great natural or man-made cataclysms, out of pure philanthropy. Ecological catastrophes are only terrifying for civilians. For the military, they are but a simulation of chaos and consequently a subject of study and an opportunity for large-scale maneuvers in open terrain. Even better, in the state of undeclared war in which we live, this study is not only useful, but indispensable.
The more that time intervals are abolished, the more image of space dilates. You would think that an explosion had occurred all over the planet. The least nook and cranny are dragged out of the shade by a stark light, wrote Ernst Jünger, of that illumination which lights up the reality of the world. The coming of the live, of direct transmissions, brought about by turning the limit speed of waves to effect, transformed the old television into a planetary grand-scale optics. With CNN and its various offshoots, domestic television has given way to telesurveillance.
Virilio speaks of the coming domestic telesurveillance. We think of the hundreds of thousands of cameras watching over streets, parks, and business. Then the doorbell cameras, all the cameras willingly installed in the home to detect burglars or watch over baby, all hooked up to Wi-Fi, ready for big tech or big hacking tech, and it's hard to tell which is which. Virilio constantly refers to the development of globalitarianism, which is prepared to revive the totalitarianisms of the past, and the militarization of civilian life, or civilianization of the military, their marriage in both function and form. For Virilio, the Germans are always marching into his beloved Nantes to break us again into the collaborators and the resistance. He says the computer is no longer simply a device for consulting information sources, but an automatic vision machine operating within the space of an entirely virtualized geographical reality. The net is a lens for looking at the world, but as it grows, the former real world of three-dimensional objects around us shrinks and fades away.
The dictatorship of the screen.
The cinema involved putting the eye into uniform, claimed Kafka. What are we to say, then, of this dictatorship exerted for more than half a century by optical hardware, which has become omniscient and omnipresent, and which, like any totalitarian regime, encourages us to forget we are individuated beings?
Daily, our images posted by us or taken by security cameras can be used by the military or police. Police regularly search social media pictures, often helped by other social media users. But corporations and advertisers, even artists, can appropriate your image, manipulate it, sell it, and misuse our optical clones. Virilio outlines how the advent of mass books via Gutenberg's invention led to generations of deaf mutes, each with their own copy to read privately, silently. The former necessity of public reading of rare manuscripts disappeared. Then, with optical technology, the image has replaced the word for many people, leading to a new kind of blindness of immediate and personal reality. We hoard masses of images, become their curators. We become confused which we have seen and which we have seen in reality, and that matters less and less. Our consciousness lives in mounds of images prepared by others and offered in a planned stream by a mixture of vested interests, a trending fad, and chaos. You are what your mind eats. The presidents and other alleged leaders, says Virilio, cease to address themselves to that nation. They would, all in all, go with the general flow of the silent revolution of the audiovisual world. Leaders are now made by and out of images and impressions carried by telecommunications. They are puppets too, not puppet masters. There is no longer, strictly speaking, either right or left, and that, since the fall of the Berlin Wall, these things literally no longer have any meaning. All that remains is the great audio-visual dilemma, the conflict between the soft, the word, and the hard, the image. To prefer the illusions of networks, drawing on the absolute speed of electronic impulses, which give, or claim to give, instantaneously what time accords only gradually, means not only making light of geographical dimensions, as the acceleration of rapid vehicles has been doing for more than a century now, but, above all, hiding the future in the ultra-short time span of telematic live transmissions, It means making the future no longer appear to exist by having it happen now. Thus, after the atom bomb and the deployment for over 40 years of generalized nuclear deterrence, the information bomb, which has just exploded, will very soon require the establishment of a new type of deterrence. In this case, a societal one, with automatic circuit breakers put in place, capable of avoiding the overheating, if not indeed the fission, of the social cores of nations. With the real-time globalization of telecommunications, the unofficial model for which is provided by the Internet, the information revolution shows itself to be also a systematic snooping operation, which triggers a panic phenomenon of rumor and suspicion, and which is set to ruin the foundations of truth in a professional ethics and hence the freedom of the press. He sees the Internet as the most immense enterprise of opinion transformation ever attempted in peacetime.
Contact us, radio@ecoshock.org.
We are thus moving imperceptibly towards a sort of image crash. The famous virtual bubble of financial markets will be supplanted by the visual bubble of the collective imaginary, with the attendant risk of the explosion of the information bomb.
We now turn to Paul Virilio's later book, The University of Disaster. It was first published in French in 2007 with English translation in 2010. I credit his translator, Julie Rose, because Virilio develops minefields of words, invented or used in new ways. Translation could not have been easy. Even in English, I feel the need to translate some Virilio into ideas for the rest of us. This Virilio book, The University of Disaster, comes with some assembly required. The introductory chapter, Intuition, assumes we are already familiar with his work and some of his terms. For example, there is no explanation when dromology and other words he coins appear. After reading further, it does become clearer. Descriptions on the back of book covers are often poor guides to a work. In this case, the writing is mostly assembled from Virilio's words itself. This back cover blurb is deep and thought-provoking on its own, so I'm just going to read it out here. Quote, "Today we find ourselves faced not only with the greenhouse effect of global warming, but also with confinement within the tighter and tighter limits of a dromosphere, where the depletion of spatial-temporal distances complements the destructive changes in the Earth's atmosphere and the loss of diversity in the biosphere. The depth of time, the sense of a past and a future, is increasingly eclipsed by the eternal present. In London, New York, and Tokyo, advertising displays are continuously updated on digital screens linked by the Internet, so that the same message is conveyed at the same time in a present that has no depth of field. An unanticipated victim of this spatial-temporal compression is science, not only biology but also physics, the big science, now confronted by a space-time contraction of the known world and of acquired knowledge. The sciences have rushed forward to produce their biotechnologies of life and matter, but have failed to address their own ethical and philosophical deficits, whence the need for a university of disaster that would constitute the mea culpa of the sciences. This university of disaster would include a kind of hospital of science and technology that would face up to the accident in knowledge, resulting not so much from the failures of the sciences as from their spectacular successes. So that from now on this old earth of ours, the climate necessary for the life of our minds, like that necessary for the life of our bodies, could be treated like a patient suffering from the fatal consequences of a long-term illness. So we come to a future that can only be imagined as disaster, and time now consists of a series of disasters. Here is how Virilio puts it. Time no longer escapes history here. History has killed it. The anthropologist Marc Auger specified in relation to Chernobyl. Today, only a catastrophe is likely to produce the effect comparable to the slow action of time. Sudden, unforeseen death. The past is now dated, Overnight, the place has been declared a desert. Everything is happening, Auger continues, as though the future could no longer be imagined, except as the memory of a disaster, which we only have a foreboding of right now. In fact, if a ruin is what remains of what once was in the past, today what remains of what happens more than anything else is ex abrupto, this large-scale accident that now dominates the event everywhere you turn. This is not some malaise in civilization anymore, but a malaise in the very actuality of cultural events. Virilio speaks of, quote, resentment towards the black utopia of a disaster that would force all of humanity, along with all humanity's diverse faculties, to vacate the premises and go into exile God knows where, far from the here and now, in the other world of cybernetic illuminism, end quote. Here's more from Virilio on what he calls the new meteorology. The new meteorology will need to try and come to grips with the mysteries, the enigmas, of the space-time of an accelerating dromosphere that escapes our projections, with its terrorizing high-pressure systems, its unknown economic storms and precipitations, to say nothing of climate change, and its repercussions on the settlement of a terrestrial globe that is turned into a reduced-scale model. He says not just governments, but banks, insurance, and investment companies are now employing catastrophe simulation software to anticipate the future. I conclude everything has to be translated or reduced to numbers to go into the matrix system of international communications and sales. If it doesn't fit into digital form, it is not there. Since most of our new so-called reality comes through screens, mediated by the algorithms of giant tech firms like Google and Facebook, most of our thoughts and activity take place there and not here. The here has been replaced.
In 2008, communications expert Kirsten Amico McAllister published a critique called Virilio, Mimesis, Mourning, and Modern Technology. McAllister wrote,
"Vision machines also threaten memory because they reduce our ability to retain mental images. Over time, with the reliance on vision machines, the human body decreasingly perceives and recollects. Instead, it simply receives whatever images flash before it." Virilio concludes that the body is reduced to a simple organism drawn to phatic images and other stimuli. The phatic image is, quote, "a targeted image that forces you to look and holds your attention. It is not only a pure product of photographic and cinematic focusing, it is the result of an ever brighter illumination of the intensity of its definition, singling out only specific areas, the context mostly disappearing into a blur." Here, Virilio suggests that like infants, we are drawn to intense images rather than exploring the underlying forces of what is at play.
That reading was from Kirsten McAllister, Simon Fraser University.
The extension of our senses by all manner of tools, from microscopes to TV, has falsified our relationships to the real as well as to the imaginary. The new techno-self, Virilio tells us, is like a plant. We absorb the light of information, images, and opinions from the global instant system. This is a new kind of photosynthesis. The techno-self absorbs the light from a sun it cannot look at directly, or it risks losing vision altogether. The new instant absorbs us, and like the sun-facing heliotropism of plants, we all turn in unison to be fed synthetic experience. Virilio says what was our local self is now our unconscious. We lose awareness of our local selves. Incoming information of all kinds becomes our consciousness. Media provides our memories, conversation, and packaged stories to the image we are living. Sir John Eccles said around 2002, "The brain looks to be more of a receiver of consciousness than a transmitter." Were we already built for passive reception when the accident occurred and then evolved to fit us and shape us? It seems our minds have been colonized and anesthetized. The system takes over all calculations of numbers. Who can multiply in their minds anymore? so we become numerically illiterate. The Global Instant provides our topics of personal thoughts and conversations. We discuss Hollywood trivia, sports, or a missing white woman, and never see the homeless or the overdose bodies. Objectified lifestyles take over where our experiences used to be. The biggest disaster of all is to be unplugged, which leaves us thoughtless and blind. Paul uses the image of the plant and photosynthetic existence in the dramasphere. We have become information heliostats. In this developing, compressed global instant, humans are destabilized. Millions of people are upset to the point of quitting, of revolution, crime, or mass killings, but they do not know why. It is like living in a pressure-sensitive bomb. Almost anything could set it off. We are living in the information bomb, which is exploding in the past, present, and future. But Virilio assumes all of us have been swept away in a transformational other with no locus. He misses the continuation of local experience by a large portion of humanity. In between souls living online and the unconnected peasant farmer is a middle, composed of bivalent minds, shall we say. Just as we recognize bisexuality, some of us maintain two homes. One is in global digital time, yes, but the other is still experiencing the physical present in all kinds of ways. What if global connectivity is added to our evolving minds rather than subtracting or replacing local existence, as Virilio claims? Virilio gives us a warning about giving up ourself to become part of an instantaneous, manufactured global network. Quote, "It is all about paving the way for a universal remote control. In such a remote-controlled existence, the individual will be kept in constant contact at every moment and at every point in their trajectory, so that they will no longer be left with any spare time. In other words, any free time, time for reflection, for prolonged introspection." If you take only one thing away from this program, Paul Virilio warns, do not dive fully into the whirlpool of the expanding global mind system. While Mark Zuckerberg invites you to move into his metaverse, Virilio warns you may lose yourself there and your soul. To my mind, the only hope to preserve the self that experiences living is to reserve large parts of your time for reality, for events, relationships, pour love and work into real people in real places in the physical world. That is the anchor that restores time, space, and your creative consciousness. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening.